This struck us as quite unbelievable. But Euthydemus said, "Do you disbelieve it, Socrates?" "Only," I said, "insofar as it seems likely that you too are wise." "Well," he said, "if you're willing to answer me, I'll show that you too admit these marvels." "Why that," I said, "is the pleasantest way for me to be refuted. For if I've been wise all this time without knowing it myself, and you're going to show that I know everything and always have, what greater windfall could I find in my whole life?" "Answer then," he said. "Ask away, since I'm ready to answer." "Well then, Socrates," he said, "are you a knower of something or not?"
"I am."
"Then is it by that very thing by which you're a knower that you also know, or by something else?" "By that by which I'm a knower, I suppose you mean the soul, or don't you mean that?" "Aren't you ashamed, Socrates," he said, "to answer a question with a question?" "Well," I said, "what am I to do?" "I'll do just as you tell me." "When I don't know what you're asking, are you telling me to answer anyway, rather than ask for clarification?" "Surely you grasp something," he said, "of what I mean."
"I do," I said.
"Then answer according to what you grasp." "But what," I said, "if you mean one thing by your question and I grasp another, and then answer according to that, is it enough for you if I answer nothing to the point?"
"It's enough for me," he said, "though not, I think, for you."
"Then, by Zeus," I said, "I won't answer at all until I understand."
"You won't answer," he said,
"according to whatever you happen to grasp each time, because you're being deliberately tiresome and more old-fashioned than you ought to be." And I realized he was annoyed with me for picking apart what was said, since he wanted to hunt me down by cornering me with words. So I remembered Canus, who also gets annoyed with me whenever I don't yield to him, and afterward pays me less attention, thinking me a dullard. And since I'd made up my mind to keep studying under him too, I thought I'd better give way, so he wouldn't think me a hopeless pupil and refuse to take me on. So I said, "Well, if that's how you think it should be done, Euthydemus, it must be done that way. For surely you know how to argue far better than I do, having the art, while I'm just an amateur. So ask again from the beginning."
"Answer then," he said. "Once more, do you know things by means of something or not?"
"I do," I said, "by my soul."
"There he goes again," he said, adding something extra to his answers.
"I didn't ask you what it is you know something by. I asked whether you know something by anything at all."
"Well," I said, "I answered more fully than I needed to, out of sheer inexperience.
Forgive me, I'll answer simply from now on. Yes, I know the things I know by something."
"Is it always," he said, "the same thing or sometimes this and sometimes something else?"
"Always," I said, "whenever I know anything by that same thing."
"Will you stop tacking things on?"
He said, "Watch that this always doesn't trip us up."
"It won't trip us up," I said. "If it trips anyone, it's you.
Just answer, do you always know by this same thing?"
"Always," I said, "since I have to drop the whenever."
"So you always know by this thing."
"And knowing always, do you know some things by the thing you know by, and other things by something else? Or do you know everything by this one thing?"
"By this one thing," I said, "everything I know."
"There it is again," he said, "the same little addition creeping back in."
"Fine, I'll drop everything I know," I said.
"Don't drop even that," he said. "I don't need you to drop anything.
Just answer me. Could you know everything if you didn't know everything?"
"That would be a miracle," I said.
And he said, "Then add whatever you like from now on. You've already agreed you know everything."
"So it seems," I said, "since the things I know turns out to carry no weight and I know everything."
"And haven't you also agreed that you always know by the same thing you know by, whether whenever you know or however you like to put it?"
"You've agreed you always know, and everything all at once." So clearly you knew even as a child, and while you were being formed in the womb and before that, before you yourself existed, and before heaven and earth existed, you knew everything, if indeed you always know. And by Zeus, he said, you will always keep on knowing everything yourself if I so wish it. I do wish you would wish it, my most honored Euthydemus, I said, if what you say is really true. But I don't quite trust that you're capable of it on your own, unless your brother here, Dionysodorus, joins in the wishing with you. Then perhaps it might happen. Tell me both, I said, for on everything else I have no idea how I could argue with men so monstrously wise, given that I don't know everything, since you two say I do. But how am I to say I know something like this, Euthydemus, that good men are unjust? Come, tell me, do I know this or not? You certainly know it, he said. Know what? I said, that good men are not unjust. Quite so, I said. I've known that for ages. But that's not what I'm asking. I'm asking where I learned that good men are unjust. Nowhere, said Dionysodorus. Then I don't know that, I said. You're ruining the argument, Euthydemus said to Dionysodorus. He'll turn out not to know something, and be knowing and unknowing at the same time. And Dionysodorus blushed. But you, Euthydemus, what do you say? I said, don't you think your brother is right, the one who knows everything? Am I not Euthydemus's brother? Dionysodorus cut in quickly. And I said, let it be, my good man, until Euthydemus teaches me that I know good men to be unjust. Don't begrudge me the lesson. You're running away, Socrates, said Dionysodorus. You don't want to answer. Naturally, I said. I'm weaker than even one of you, so I'm a long way from being ashamed to run from two. I'm a good deal feebler than Heracles, who couldn't fight off both the Hydra, a sophist of a sort, who for all her wisdom sprouted many heads to replace the one you cut off, and a certain crab, another sophist freshly arrived from the sea, just landed, I imagine. When the crab annoyed him by biting from the left as he argued, he called on his nephew Iolaus for help, and Iolaus helped him well enough. But if my Iolaus Patrocles were to come, he'd only make things worse. Well, answer this, said Dionysodorus. Since you keep singing that song, was Iolaus more Heracles's nephew than yours? My best course, Dionysodorus, I said, is simply to answer you. You'll never stop asking, I'm quite sure of that, out of sheer spite, trying to keep Euthydemus from teaching me that clever thing. Answer then, he said. I answer, I said, that Iolaus was Heracles's nephew and not mine at all as far as I can tell. Patrocles, my brother, wasn't his father. His father was someone with a similar name, Iphicles, Heracles's brother. And Patrocles, he said, is your brother. Certainly, I said, on my mother's side, though not on my father's. Then he's your brother, and not your brother. Not on the father's side, my excellent friend, I said. His father was Charidemus, mine was Sophroniscus. And was Sophroniscus a father, he said, and Charidemus too. Certainly, I said, mine and his. Then, he said, Charidemus was different from your father. Different from mine, yes, I said. So then was he a father while being different from a father? Or are you the same as a stone? I'm afraid, I said, you'll show me to be the same, though I don't think I am. Then you're different from a stone. He said, different indeed. Well then, being different from stone, aren't you not stone? And being different from gold, aren't you not gold? That's so. Then Charidemus too, he said, being different from a father wouldn't be a father. It seems, I said, he isn't a father. Well then, if Charidemus is a father, said Euthydemus, taking it up, then by the same reasoning Sophroniscus, being different from a father, isn't a father, so you, Socrates, are fatherless. and Ctesippus jumped in. Hasn't your own father suffered the very same fate? Isn't he different from my father?
Far from it, said Euthydemus.
So he's the same.
The same indeed.
I wouldn't wish that on him.
But tell me, Euthydemus, is he only my father, or everyone else's too?
Everyone's, he said.
Or do you think someone can be a father and not be a father?
I did think so, said Ctesippus.
And what of it?
He said,
can something be gold and not be gold?
Or a man and not a man?
Don't, said Ctesippus. Euthydemus, as the saying goes, don't tie linen to linen, you're saying something outrageous, that your father is everyone's father.
But he is, he said.
Everyone's as in all men's,
said Ctesippus, or of horses too and all the other animals.
Of all, he said.
And your mother too, is she everyone's mother?
My mother too.
Then your mother is also the mother of sea urchins.
So is yours, he said.
Then you're the brother of gudgeons, and puppies and piglets.
And so are you, he said.
So a boar is your father and a dog.
And yours too, he said.
And soon enough, said Dionysodorus, if you answer me, Ctesippus, you'll admit all this.
Tell me, do you have a dog?
A wretched one, said Ctesippus.
Does he have puppies?
He does, several just like him.
So the dog is their father.
I saw him myself, he said, mounting the bitch.
Well then, isn't the dog yours?
Certainly.
Then, being a father, he's yours. So the dog becomes your father, and you're the brother of puppies.
And Dionysodorus quickly cut in again, before Ctesippus could say anything.
And answer me one more small thing, do you beat this dog?
And Ctesippus laughed and said, by the gods, yes, since I can't beat you.
So you beat your own father.
He said,
it would be far more just, he said, for me to beat your father for raising sons so wise.
But surely, Euthydemus, said Ctesippus, your father and the puppy's father has enjoyed plenty of good from this wisdom of yours.
But neither he nor you, Ctesippus, has any need of plenty of goods.
And you yourself, Euthydemus, he said, don't need them either.
Nor does any other man on earth.
Tell me, Ctesippus, do you think it's a good thing for a sick man to drink medicine, or not good when he needs it?
Or when a man goes to war, is it better to go armed or unarmed?
I'd say armed, he said, though I suspect you're about to say something clever.
You'll soon know best, he said, just answer.
Since you've agreed it's good for a man to drink medicine when he needs it, doesn't it follow that this good thing should be drunk in the greatest possible quantity? And it would be well done if someone ground up a whole cartload of hellebore and mixed it in for him.
And Ctesippus said, very much so, Euthydemus, provided the drinker is the size of the statue at Delphi.
And in war too, he said, since it's good to have weapons, shouldn't one have as many spears and shields as possible, since it's a good thing?
Quite so surely, said Ctesippus.
But you don't think that, Euthydemus, you'd settle for one shield and one spear?
I would.
And would you arm Geryon and Briareus that way too?
He said,
I thought you'd be clever than that, being a master of arms yourself, and your friend here too.
Euthydemus fell silent.
But Dionysodorus, picking up on Ctesippus's earlier answers, asked, and don't you think gold is good to have?
Certainly, and plenty of it, said Ctesippus.
Well then, don't you think one ought to have good things always and everywhere?
Very much so, he said.
And you agree gold is a good thing?
I've agreed to that, he said.
Then one ought to have it always and everywhere, and as much of it as possible within oneself.
And wouldn't a man be happiest who had 3 talents of gold in his belly, 1 talent in his skull, and a gold stater in each eye? Well, Euthydemus, said Ctesippus, they do say the happiest and best men among the Scythians are those who carry a great deal of gold in their own skulls, just as you said the dog was my father a moment ago. And what's even more remarkable, they drink from their own gilded skulls and look right down inside them, holding their own crown in their hands. Do the Scythians and other men, said Euthydemus, see what is possible to see or what is impossible? What is possible, surely. And you too. He said, I too. Do you see our cloaks? Yes. Then these are possible to see. Remarkably so, said Ctesippus. What of it? He said, nothing. But perhaps you don't think they're actually visible. You're such a delight. You seem to me, Euthydemus, to be sound asleep with your eyes open. And if it's possible to say something while saying nothing, that's exactly what you're doing. Isn't it possible, said Dionysodorus, to speak while being silent? Not in any way at all, said Ctesippus. Or to be silent while speaking? Even less so, he said. Then when you speak of stones and sticks and bits of iron, aren't you speaking while being silent? Not if I'm speaking of them, he said, unless when I walk past the blacksmith's shops, the bits of iron speak and shout at the top of their lungs when someone strikes them. So your wisdom made you say nothing there without noticing it. But show me the other one still, how it's possible to speak while being silent. And Ctesippus seemed to me terribly on edge over his boyfriend's honor. When you're silent, said Euthydemus, aren't you silent about everything? I am, he said. Then you're also silent about the things that speak, if speech belongs among all things. What? Said Ctesippus, isn't everything silent? Surely not, said Euthydemus. Then, my good man, does everything speak? The things that speak do, surely. But that's not what I'm asking, he said. I'm asking whether everything is silent or everything speaks. Neither and both, said Dionysodorus, snatching it up, for I know well you won't know what to do with that answer. And Ctesippus, as he always did, burst out in a great roar of laughter and said, Euthydemus, your brother has hedged the argument both ways at once, he's lost and beaten. And Cleinias was thoroughly delighted and laughed, so that Ctesippus grew more than tenfold pleased with himself. And it seemed to me, given how crafty he is, that Ctesippus had picked up these very tricks from these two men themselves, for no one else among men today has wisdom quite like it. And I said, why are you laughing, Cleinias, at such serious and noble matters? Have you ever yet, Socrates, said Dionysodorus, seen a noble thing? I have, I said, and many, Dionysodorus. Are they different from the beautiful, he said, or the same as the beautiful? And I was in complete confusion, and I thought I deserved it for having yelped in the first place, but still, I said they were different from the beautiful itself, though each of them does have some beauty present in it. Well then, he said, if an ox is present to you, you're an ox. And since I'm present to you right now, are you Dionysodorus? Don't say such a thing, I said. But in what way, he said, could one thing become another just because another thing is present to it? Is that what's puzzling you? I said, and by now I was trying to imitate the cleverness of these two men, since I was so eager for it. Of course I'm puzzled, he said, and so is everyone else about what doesn't exist. What do you mean, Dionysodorus? I said, isn't the beautiful beautiful and the ugly ugly? If it seems so to me, he said. Well, does it seem so? Certainly, he said. And isn't the same, and the different, different? Surely the different isn't the same. I wouldn't have thought even a child would be puzzled that the different is different. But Dionysodorus, you let that one go on purpose,
since in everything else you two seem to me like craftsmen who each turn out exactly what belongs to their trade, and you two turn out arguing most beautifully of all.
So do you know, he said, what belongs to each of the craftsmen?
First, do you know who ought to do metalwork?
I do a smith.
And who ought to do pottery?
A potter.
And who ought to slaughter and skin animals, and cut up the meat and boil and roast it?
A cook, I said.
Then if someone does what belongs to him, he'll do it correctly.
Certainly.
And it belongs to the cook, as you say, to cut up and skin.
You agreed to that, didn't you?
I agreed, I said, but forgive me.
Then it's clear, he said, that if someone slaughters the cook and cuts him up and boils and roasts him, he'll be doing what belongs to him. And if someone forges the smith himself or pots the potter, he too will be doing what belongs to him.
By Poseidon, I said, now you're putting the crowning touch on your wisdom.
Will it ever come to me so that it becomes my own?
Would you recognize it, Socrates, he said, once it had become your own?
If you're willing, clearly I would, I said.
Well, he said, do you think you know what belongs to you?
Unless you mean something else by it, since we have to begin with you and end up with Euthydemus here.
Well then, he said, do you consider those things to be yours which you have authority over and are permitted to use however you wish?
For instance, an ox or a sheep, would you consider those yours, things you'd be permitted to sell, give away, or sacrifice to whichever god you liked?
And whatever isn't like that isn't yours.
And I, knowing that something fine was about to hatch out of these questions, and eager to hear it as quickly as possible, said, yes, indeed, that's exactly how it is. Only things of that sort are mine.
Well then, do you call living things those which have a soul?
Yes, I said.
Do you agree, then, that among living things only those are yours over which you have the authority to do all the things I just mentioned?
I agree.
And he, pausing very ironically as if considering some weighty matter, said, tell me, Socrates, do you have a Zeus of your father's?
And I, suspecting where the argument would end up, tried some evasive twist, turning this way and that like someone caught in a net already.
I don't, I said, Dionysodorus.
Then you're a wretched sort of man, and not even an Athenian, if you have no ancestral gods, no shrines, nothing else fine and good.
Enough, Dionysodorus, I said. Don't say such things and don't lecture me so harshly.
I do have altars and shrines, both household and ancestral, and everything else that other Athenians have of that kind.
Then don't other Athenians, he said, have Zeus as their ancestral god?
They don't, I said.
That title belongs to none of the Ionians, neither those who colonized from this city nor us. Rather, Apollo is our ancestral god because of the birth of Ion.
Zeus isn't called ancestral for us, but of the household and of the clan, and Athena is of the clan too.
Well, that's enough, said Dionysodorus.
You do have Apollo, it seems, and Zeus and Athena.
Certainly, I said.
Then these would be gods that are yours.
He said,
ancestors, I said, and masters.
But yours all the same, he said, or haven't you agreed they're yours?
I've agreed, I said, what else can I do?
Then, he said, aren't these gods also living things?
You've agreed that whatever has a soul is a living thing.
Or do these gods not have souls?
They do, I said.
So they're living things.
Living things, I said.
And among living things, he said, you've agreed that those are yours which you're permitted to give away, sell, and sacrifice to whatever god you please.
I've agreed, I said. There's no wriggling out of it for me, Euthydemus.
Come then, tell me right away, he said. Since you agree that Zeus and the other gods are yours, are you permitted to sell them, or give them away,
or do whatever else you like with them, just as with your other property.
As for me, Credo, I lay there speechless, as if struck by the argument.
And Ctesippus came to my rescue, saying, Well, by Heracles, what a fine argument!
And Dionysodorus said, So is Heracles well, or is well Heracles?
And Ctesippus said, By Poseidon, what terrible arguments!
I give up, the two of you are unbeatable.
At that point, dear Credo, every single person present praised the argument and the two men to the skies, and they nearly collapsed from laughing and clapping and rejoicing.
At every earlier point, Euthydemus's own admirers alone had cheered gloriously. But this time, even the pillars in the Lyceum practically cheered for the two men and delighted in them.
As for me, I too was so affected that I admitted I had never seen men so wise, and thoroughly enslaved by their cleverness, I turned to praising and extolling them and said, How blessed you two are in your marvelous natures, to have accomplished such a feat so quickly and in so little time.
Your arguments have many other fine qualities, Euthydemus and Dionysodorus, but among them this is the most magnificent. You care nothing for the majority of people, the dignified ones who think themselves somebody, but only for people like yourselves.
I know well that very few people, only those like you, would enjoy these arguments, while the rest are so ignorant of them that I'm sure they'd be more ashamed to refute others with such arguments than to be refuted themselves.
And here's another thing about your arguments, democratic and gentle. Whenever you say that nothing is beautiful, nor good, nor white, nor anything else of that sort, and that nothing at all differs from anything else, you quite literally stitch shut people's mouths, just as you claim to do.
But that you'd seem to do this not only to others' arguments, but to your own as well. That's really quite charming, and it takes away the offensiveness of the whole business.
And the greatest thing of all is that you have this worked out so skillfully that anyone at all could learn it in a very short time.
I saw this myself, watching Ctesippus, how quickly he was able to imitate you on the spot.
This cleverness of yours, then, is fine for handing on quickly, but it isn't suitable for arguing in front of people. Rather, if you'll take my advice, you'll be careful not to speak in front of a crowd, so that people don't learn it quickly and then feel no gratitude toward you.
Best of all, converse with each other alone, just the two of you, or if in front of anyone else, only in front of whoever pays you money.
And if you're wise, you'll give your students this same advice. Never argue with anyone at all except with you two and with each other. For what is scarce is precious, Euthydemus, while water, the best thing there is the cheapest, as Pindar said.
But come, I said, see to it that you take on both me and Clanias here as students.
We talked about this, Credo, and a few other small things, and then we left.
So think about how you'll join in studying with these two men, since they claim to be able to teach whoever is willing to pay, and that no nature and no age bars anyone, and this especially concerns you, that nothing prevents you from making money either, so nothing should stop anyone at all from easily taking up their wisdom.
Well, Socrates, I'm certainly fond of listening, and I'd gladly learn something, but I'm afraid I too may be one of those unlike Euthydemus, one of those, as you were saying, who would rather be refuted by such arguments than refute others with them. Still, though it seems ridiculous to me to lecture you, I do want to report what I heard. As you were all leaving, someone came up to me while I was walking about, a man who thinks himself very wise indeed, one of those clever at the arguments used in the law courts, and said, Credo, aren't you listening to these wise men at all? No, by Zeus, I said, I couldn't get close enough to hear anything over the crowd. Well, he said, it would have been worth hearing. Why is that? I said, so that you could have heard men speaking who are now the wisest at this kind of argument. And I said, well, what did you think of them? What else? He said, but what one always hears from such people, babbling nonsense and making a great fuss over things worth nothing, that's more or less how he put it in his own words. And I said, but surely philosophy is a charming thing. Charming, my dear fellow, he said. Worth nothing at all, and if you'd been there just now, I think you'd have been quite ashamed on behalf of your friend. He was so out of place, willing to expose himself to men who don't care in the least what they say, and who latch on to every single word. And these two, as I was just saying, are among the best at it today. But really, Credo, he said, the thing itself, and the men who spend their time on it, are worthless and ridiculous. Now, Socrates, it seemed to me that he wasn't right to find fault with the thing itself, whether it was him or anyone else finding fault with it. But he did seem right to me in objecting to their willingness to argue that way in front of a crowd of people.
Credo, men of that sort are astonishing. But I still don't know what I'm about to say. Which kind of man was it who came up to you and found fault with philosophy? One of those formidable at contesting cases in the law courts, an orator, or one of those who supply such men, a composer of the speeches orators use in their contests?
Certainly not an orator, by Zeus. I don't think he's ever set foot in a law court. But they say he understands the subject, by Zeus, and is clever, and puts together clever arguments.
Now I understand. I was about to say the same thing myself just now about men of this kind. These, Credo, are the ones Prodicus called the borderland between the philosopher and the statesman, and they think themselves the wisest of all people, and beyond actually being so, also seeming so among a great many. So much so that they think the only people standing in the way of their being esteemed by everyone are those devoted to philosophy. So they suppose that if they can bring these philosophers into disrepute, so that they seem worth nothing, then they'll carry off the prize for wisdom uncontested in everyone's opinion. For they truly believe themselves the wisest, but when they get caught out in their own private discussions, they're cut down to size by the likes of Euthydemus. And they think themselves quite wise, reasonably enough, since they have a moderate share of philosophy and a moderate share of statesmanship, on a quite reasonable calculation, for they partake of both just as much as they need, while staying out of dangers and contests and reaping the fruits of their wisdom.
Well then, do you think they have a point, Socrates? For indeed, the argument does have a certain plausibility to it, as far as these men go.
Yes, Credo, and in fact it has more surface plausibility than truth. It's not easy to convince them that when human beings, or anything else, stand between two things and share in both, then whatever is composed of a bad thing, and a good thing is better than the one and worse than the other. But whatever is composed of two good things not aimed at the same purpose is, in relation to whichever purpose each of those components was good for, worse than both. While only what is composed of two bad things not aimed at the same thing and stands between them is better than each of those things it shares a part of. So if philosophy is a good thing and statesmanship is a good thing, but each aims at something different, and these men, sharing in both, stand between them, then they're talking nonsense because they're inferior to both. But if one is good and the other bad, then they're better than the practitioners of the bad one and worse than the practitioners of the good one. And if both are bad, then there's some truth in what they say, but in no other case. So I don't think they'd ever admit that both are bad, or that one is bad and the other good. No, the truth is that these people, sharing in both, fall short of both in relation to whatever it is that makes statesmanship and philosophy each worth taking seriously, and being in truth third-rate, they're trying to seem first-rate. Well, we should forgive them their ambition and not be harsh with them, but we should recognize them for what they are. After all, we ought to have some regard for any man who says anything at all that touches on wisdom, and who works hard and bravely to see an argument through.
And yet, Socrates, as I keep telling you, when it comes to my own sons, I'm at a loss what to do with them. The younger one is still small, but Critobulus is already of an age and needs someone who'll do him some good. Whenever I'm with you, I find myself thinking it's sheer madness that for the sake of children people take such great pains over so many other things, over the marriage, so that the children will come from the noblest possible mother, and over money, so that they'll be as rich as possible and yet neglect their children's own education. But then whenever I look at one of these men who claim they can educate people, I'm astonished, and each one of them, on examination, strikes me as thoroughly bizarre, to tell you the truth. So I don't know how I'm supposed to steer the boy toward philosophy.
My dear Credo, don't you know that in every pursuit the mediocre are many and worth nothing, while the serious ones are few and worth everything? Take gymnastics, for instance. Don't you think it's a fine thing? And money-making and rhetoric and generalship.
I certainly do, in every case.
Well then, in each of these, don't you see that the majority of people, measured against the real work of it, are laughable?
Yes, by Zeus, that's very true.
So is that any reason for you to run from all these pursuits yourself, and to forbid your son from taking them up?
No, that wouldn't be fair, Socrates.
Then don't do what you shouldn't, Credo. Instead, let the practitioners of philosophy be, whether they're good or worthless, and examine the thing itself carefully and well. If it looks to you like something worthless, then steer everyone away from it, not just your sons. But if it turns out to be what I believe it is, then take heart and pursue it and train in it, as the saying goes, both you yourself and your children.